We've gathered for a special hearing here this morning, AstraZeneca versus Breath Limited. Mr. Sipes.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Sipes. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff's appellant, AstraZeneca, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal with the court's leave. There are two patent issues. There's the 834 patent to sterile powders, formulations, and methods of producing the same, and the 603 to methods of treating respiratory diseases. With the court's permission, I'd like to start with the 834 patent.
I don't know if my colleagues feel the same way, but I would be more interested in hearing from you on the 603, and since time sometimes catches up with us, if you don't mind, and that doesn't disrupt your argument unduly, that would be helpful to me.
Of course.
While you're flipping pages, let me make sure I understand. What is the practical consequence if we should, for example, sustain the district court on the 603 but reverse the claim construction on the 834?
We think it's clear, Your Honor, that the lower court's finding of non-infringement under the 834 cannot stand if her claim construction is reversed, and as we believe, the claim is restored to being a product claim. The claim is finally divided butasinide powder for the meaning of micronized powder composition. And in that case, it should be sent back to the district court. We don't think, although I suspect that others may disagree, but that there be even a dispute over infringement with the proper construction. But at minimum, there would need to be a new finding on infringement, and I believe they've asserted validity challenges that would need to be considered.
There are pending validity challenges of the 834?
That is my understanding.
All right, and I take it that, you can tell me this. It's just a couple of questions, right, and I won't interrupt. The two claims that are asserted under the 834 are 1 and 50, right?
Can we switch back to the 834 now?
I just had a question on the 834 that I want to make sure that I've got, since that case may have to go back. And
those,
if it does, 1 and 50.
Well, 1 and 50 are the two independent claims.
50 is the one that deals with the sterile suspension and 1 with the sterile powder.
That's correct.
So it's really, is your theory that 50 is the one that's infringed, not 1?
In terms of literal infringement, for at least two of the three, the literal infringement would occur under Claim 50. Claim 50 is not the central claim.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, you're exactly right. That Claim 50 makes it clear that the criteria of sterility, the requirement of sterility, applies to the aqueous suspension, not to the powder directly, which is why non-infringement based on the idea that it has to be dry and sterile at the same time does not apply to Claim 50. So let me turn, Your Honor, if you prefer, to the 603 patent. The errors here, it's quite an extensive opinion, but I think the error that is fundamental here is that the court relied heavily on the expert testimony of defendant's expert, not to understand the teachings of the prior art, but to fill in some pretty clear gaps in that, and that she was unduly influenced. And we think that's candidly a legal error. You're not entitled to, it's an error to read the prior art supplementing it with expert testimony rather than using the expert testimony to understand the prior art. That was most evident, we believe, in the anticipation holding, but equally evident in the obviousness holding, particularly with regard to the dependent claims to children. And for example, Claim 16, which is children 6 months to 5 years. The defendants put on the testimony of Dr. Barnes, who is the author of the article that the district court found anticipated. I think there's always a risk when the author of an article is testifying, because it can be hard to distinguish sometimes between what the article says and what the author is saying, in some sense, from hindsight, what he wishes he had said. And I think that's clear from Barnes, where there's only one sentence in each of the sections that the court really, that was key. There's a section on studies in children on page 19150 that refers to using nebulized budesonide in children. On the next page, there's a single sentence in a different section, frequency of administration, that said, for patients with mild asthma, one dose per day may suffice. Nothing connects those two statements. Nothing in the article.
Anything on once daily?
The once per day is on page 19151. It says, it's at the last sentence of the section, frequency administration. All it says is,
yeah,
for patients with mild asthma, one dose per day may suffice. There's not even a reference to budesonide. They get to budesonide by following footnote 49, which refers to the Jones article about turbohaler once daily. That's not children, and it's not a nebulizer.
So when you're talking about nebulized budesonide, you don't talk about once daily.
Correct. The only reference for that statement about one dose per day is referring to a different device, the turbohaler, not nebulizer. And they're very different devices with very different methods.
So what about obviousness?
So let me come to obviousness. And I would just point out, because this will hit obviousness too, in between those two statements is a section on the pharmacokinetics of the drug. And in there it discusses both how the device can change the disposition of the drug and other factors, such as the age of the patient, that may alter the disposition of the inhaled dose. So in between those two sections is a discussion about how the device can affect things and the age of the patient, expressly the age of the patient. So somebody reading the whole article isn't going to connect the two statements and is going to see that the age of the patient matters. And that takes us to obviousness, because the same error applies there. If you look at the court's opinion on obviousness, and again, I want to focus on the dependent claims because I think there it's most glaring. The court relied heavily, again, on expert testimony to make all of the leaps to children. The prior art does not teach once daily administration in young children, again, focusing on 6 months to 5 years, and doesn't teach anywhere nebulized budesonide applied once daily. To get there, and particularly to get there in young children, she relied on testimony saying that a person already skilled in the art would believe that nebulizer and other devices are interchangeable.
But it's very clear that children are going to have trouble with PMDIs or DPIs. Doesn't that suggest nebulizer?
Certainly the reason nebulizer is used is because the other devices are hard, but I think that shows that the product teaches the other way. Because despite that fact, there were no studies with once daily with a nebulizer. And the studies that they point to in children for once daily, one, they're older children, but two, they're using the other device.
But we had these once daily studies that were showing itself an effect, safe and effective, right?
It shows that they are safe and effective in other devices with older children and adults. There's no, we don't believe the prior art teaches once daily in the young children, 6 months to 5 years, and nothing.
Well, we're in obviousness. It doesn't have to teach it.
It doesn't, but there has to
be a logical progression that makes it reasonably expectable that there'd be success with this. And we've just seen kind of a progression where children can't use alternative methods. It's safe and effective to use a nebulizer. Where am I missing the logical progression here?
The challenge is what the prior expressly is saying is the age of the patient matters. The device matters in terms of how it's disposed in the lungs. Nobody understood at the time why budesonide worked once daily, even in adults, even with the other device.
Did you give us any objective? Excuse me.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask about objective criteria. Maybe you can show us some objective evidence that would lead away from this logical progression.
Yes, Your Honor, and we do think there is objective evidence that the court didn't give due weight to. One is, it was undisputed in this case that once daily treatment with a nebulizer is desirable, and especially desirable in young children, because young children don't like taking medication at all. A nebulizer, unlike these other devices, is prolonged. It's a very different way of administering a drug. So there was a great desire for once daily. And the court noted that in the opinion in her obviousness. But then in weighing, for example, a commercial success and skepticism, she dismissed the idea that once daily might be what she called a sales driver. So she dismissed the commercial success.
But your skepticism was your own senior management. Isn't that discountable to some significant extent?
I don't believe so in this context, Your Honor, where the skepticism is objective, where they did an extra clinical trial because there were great concerns that once daily with a nebulizer was not effective. This is not a matter of somebody simply creating a document to try to support skepticism. This is running an entirely additional clinical trial. And I think, as the court is aware, that's an expensive and difficult undertaking. It's particularly difficult here where the patients were 6 months to 8 years recruiting young children as hard in clinical trials. So this is truly objective evidence of skepticism. It's not somehow manufactured evidence.
Mr. Sipes, if we were to affirm the district court's ruling on obviousness with respect to the method claims that were held on, obvious, is there any argument on validity that would remain that would apply to the method claims that the district court declined to rule on? That's method claims 6, 11, 18, and 21 to 23. Is there any reason why that would sustain the validity of those claims over the validity of the other claims, since they all appear to be broader?
I'm not aware, for example, with regard to claim 6, as to whether or not some of those diseases might be different. So I can't, and I apologize, I can't say that I've thought about whether or not some of the dependent claims that we've not discussed in the brief might survive.
Each of them, in your opponent's brief, they chart out each of the claims that the district court decided not to address and said that each of them is actually broader than another claim which was invalidated. For example, in the case of 6, I think 6 is, and I think if you look at 6 and 7, 6 is clearly broader than 7. 7 is just the method of claim 6 wherein the respiratory disease is asthma. 7 was invalidated, therefore 6 presumably has to go. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. I believe that if all of the invalid claims are upheld, the collateral estoppel effect of the judgment will likely preclude enforcement of the patent in the future.
And if that's true, why not simply have a single judgment here rather than requiring these claims to hang out there until somebody has the fortitude to attack them?
As a practical matter, it's not clear to me that it will change that much, but it is worth pointing out for two reasons, really. One, that the court did have the proper discretion not to reach those claims and to refuse to decide the DJ action, particularly in the context where its practical relevance at the time was unclear. And in addition, in essence, then what the defendants are asking you to do is to leapfrog over that collateral estoppel analysis.
Well, my question was not with respect to collateral estoppel. I'm assuming that the district court had exercised discretion and had gone forward and ruled on the validity of those claims. Is there any patentable distinction that would have been asserted to distinguish those claims from the other claims that were held invalid?
I'm not aware that there was, Your Honor.
Seems to me, for the reasons pointed out by Judge Bryson, that if they're broader than the other claims that were invalidated, they would, of necessity, were sort of dead on arrival.
That's likely the case, Your Honor.
All right. Yeah.
As a matter of policy, we have to be efficient, don't we?
Well,
I mean, if you're going to ask us to rule on every claim, or we simply, in the judiciary, don't have the resources for that.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that's why the district court recognized that it wasn't necessary to reach that and discretion counted against it. And as a practical matter, it wasn't worth the resources to do that. Let me just come back to the 834, just to make sure in case there are any questions I want to address. And to us, the key point here is that the words of the claim are clear: micronized powder composition. And that implies nothing about sterility. Micronized, as the parties seem to agree, means finely divided. And the patent at column 1, 65 to 67, describes micronized as finely divided. The court at A108 agreed, that everyone agreed, that's what micronized means. So we're using words that are clearly directed to the product, not to the process of making it. And what's important here is, clearly the intrinsic evidence shows the inventors believed correctly that they had invented not just a process for making a sterile, pharmaceutically acceptable formulation of budesonide, but that product itself, the sterile, pharmaceutically acceptable budesonide formulation. It hadn't been achieved before. Remarkably, before this invention, over in Europe. Those budesonide inhaled formulations have been sold non-sterile because of this challenge.
Let me ask you, because I think your opposing counsel is likely to call our attention to the use of the term, the word, invention, the invention in the specification, which is used several times in the specification, and they invoke the line of our cases that say when you talk about the invention, you're limiting yourself to whatever you then describe as being the invention. Could you address that?
I can. I think it's an important point. And I want to distinguish the language used in the patent here, the 834, from language you sometimes see called the present invention is. That's boilerplate that you'll see in a lot of patents. There's some question of whether or not that is limiting, but clearly its purport is very clear to define the present invention. Here is different. Here, the patent office says, according to the invention, there is provided. And there's a number of instances in which it's provided, sometimes a new process, sometimes a new product. And it was clear in reading this that the inventors believed that they had made more than one invention. Because it had been unachievable to make a pharmaceutically acceptable sterile budesonide formulation before, they had to make a process invention to achieve the product invention. And they claimed both, and they were careful to claim both. So in the field of the invention in column one, the invention relates to one is a process, but next comes sterile formulations containing glucocorticosteroids in use thereof. And then again, there's a description of according to the invention there's provided a process, but beginning on column five, a new discussion begins. The invention further provides a sterile glucocorticosteroid, preferably, and then goes on, preferably budesonide, without regard to how it's made. And then again, column 5 at line 13, according to the invention, there is further provided a sterile pharmaceutical formulation comprising a glucocorticosteroid and an aqueous suspension. So they were very clear. They believed they invented not just a process for making the product, but a whole new product. And the intrinsic evidence repeats that over and over again, that they put in statements. Applicants have also discovered pharmaceutically acceptable suspension, including sterilized particles, including budesonide. That's at A1252 in 2003 objection. And then in 2007, regardless of how desirable a sterilized budesonide composition might have been, no one except applicants know how to produce it at the present application priority date. They have come up not just with a new process, but a whole new product. They used words to make clear what they were claiming was a product. And they were very careful, I think, both in the specification and the intrinsic evidence, to argue for their process claims or the claims that were limited to a particular kind of process with those arguments, and the claims that were directed to the product on the basis that the prior art didn't produce a product whose product characteristics, specifically that it be, among other things, pharmaceutically acceptable, did not fall within the claims, that they had come up with a new product. And indeed, you know, a person who is going to be reading this, first of all, there's a heavy presumption of this ordinary. But reading the whole patent and all of the intrinsic evidence, the prosecution history, makes those two views clear, that they've not just invented a process, but a product, and that the claims at issue here was the inventor's effort to use plain words to claim the product itself.
Mr. Sipes, Judge Bryson started us out with a discussion of what happens if we sustain the district court on 603 but reverse on 834. What does that do to the injunction?
Your Honor, I believe that the injunction remained in place long enough at least for us to go back to the district court and seek an injunction from the district court with regard to the 834. I believe that the factors in favor of preliminary injunction, the likelihood of success of the merits, the reform, will continue to apply and support an injunction down there. But presumably we would go back to the district court with the status quo preserved to seek a preliminary injunction from the district court.
All right. Thank you. We are going to restore Mr. Sipes' rebuttal time. Therefore, I need to give the other side 9 minutes, Reggie. I'm not sure how we're going to divide it. Their additional 9 minutes between the two counsel. And we'll just give it all to Mr. Ricozzi?
Yes, sir.
Let's give it all to him, and you can sit down a little early if you want to share some with your colleague then.
Thank you, Your Honor. William Ricosi for the Watson and Brett defendants. I'll be presenting for the defendants, unless the court has any specific question as to Aptex or Sanders. Their counsel are obviously here. I'll start with the 834. We believe the construction was correct and required by the intrinsic evidence. And I believe, Judge Bryson, your comment on the invention is key here, because they're not entitled to claim more than they invented. And the record here is crystal clear. They were never able to get any other process to work. Filter sterilization was not possible. Steam heat was not possible. They then recounted that in their specification in columns 1 and 2. And it wasn't just saying there are a few slight problems with the prior processes.
And doesn't
they
the
said,
specification clearly separate the process from the product?
Actually, and, we would... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And it, the specification disparages sterilization from all other methods except the low heat, but...
That's correct. And we would... I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead.
We would say that it not just disparages, but in the words of Astra's own expert, it rules out those other methods. And it does connect the product to the process.
Well, I take it... Let's see if I'm mistaken in my understanding of the lay of the land here. There's nothing wrong, I take it, with saying, okay, I came up with a process that resulted in a product. The product is new, so is the process, and I claim the product, I claim the method, and I claim product by process. You can put all that in, assuming the examiner doesn't impose a restriction requirement, you put all those in a single patent. That's, there's nothing wrong with that, right?
There's nothing wrong with that in a vacuum.
Right, okay. Well, I'm starting with a vacuum.
Okay.
And that that the product protection is for that product without, assuming the vacuum, without regard to how it is produced, right? If I have a right to the, if I invented the product, I'm the first one there, I get protection from the product regardless of how it's produced, correct?
We are not arguing that a composition of matter could be patentable in and of itself,
right.
Again, in a vacuum without regard to this intrinsic record.
So doesn't your argument really come down to saying that in the specification in particular, the references to the invention suggest that there's only a single invention, notwithstanding the fact that the claims, different groups of claims, seem to fall into each of those three categories?
We would say, Your Honor, that the disclaimer is clear in the specification in and of itself, and then reconfirmed repeatedly again in the file history, because the product, if you look at column 4, when this sterilized glucocorticosteroid product first appears, it then gives you the properties of it, and then we get the statements about that product will maintain the same physical and chemical form. Then it reconnects it to the process, saying, i.e., the degradation will be limited by the presence of sterilization process.
Judge Bryson's inquiring about, isn't it kind of axiomatically wrong to read a process into a product claim?
As a general proposition, Your Honor, again, without regard to the intrinsic record here, generally process limitations are not read in. But that's the tip of the iceberg in this analysis, because even when the plain language may not seem to have the words heat sterilized in it, and we're not arguing it does, the court still needs to look at the intrinsic evidence, the specification in the file history, to see if there were disclaimers, to see if the inventors said it means something different or if they surrendered coverage. And here, they didn't just invent a product out of the ether. They told the skilled person, none of these other processes will work. They disparage them, and there's no dispute. All the experts in the intrinsic record say only the dry heat process will reach this product.
Deal with the claim differentiation where the dependent claims specifically mention the heat sterilization.
Absolutely.
Giving us a pretty strong clue that the independent doesn't have that limitation.
And the court need not be concerned with claim differentiation for a couple of different reasons. Number one, that doctrine just presumes claims are different scope. And here, claims 38 and 42, they don't depend from the asserted claims, and they are a different scope. They have different limitations, including the produced by sterilizing budesonide with viable microorganism-containing particles. It's an admitted limitation not found in any asserted claims. But even if it wasn't, Your Honor, claim differentiation cannot override disclaimer. The claims cannot be broadened beyond the specification in the file history. And here we believe, again, a clear and unmistakable disclaimer. They said none of these processes work. They're all unsuitable. We found a new process, and the product obtained thereby. They call that product repeatedly the invention. And this isn't a case of where there's just an embodiment or one of several. The only embodiment, admittedly, is the low dry heat sterilized product.
Well, we have many cases that make it clear that just because you have one embodiment, that your invention is not limited to that embodiment. You refer to the invention. If you look at column 1, the paragraph from lines 16 to 20, talks about this invention relates to a process, etc., sterile formulations, and use thereof. So the invention is described as three different things.
Is that right? That sentence says that, Your Honor, but nowhere in the specification does it ever divorce that product from the low dry heat sterilized process.
In column 5, the discussion of the sterile pharmaceutical formulation is not described as being as how it's made. There's no discussion in that column of how it's made.
Your Honor, but the sterile glucocorticosteroid is first introduced in column 4, and there it connects it to the sterile glucocorticosteroid of that sterilization process, the low dry heat process.
But where is the disclaimer that says that that's the only process?
Well, Your Honor, it is the only process disclosed in this specification. The record is undisputed, actually, not just in the spec, but the experts, that no other process will work to get this dry heat sterilized product. And we must remember here, even Astra doesn't dispute, we're talking about a sterilized budesonide product, which means something that underwent a sterilization process. Nowhere in the specification of the file history did any inventor ever say we invented budesonide by any other process, because they couldn't have. They admitted the only thing they invented was the low dry heat. And in the file history, Your Honor, it even gets more explicit. In the sections where they say applicant's invention, they actually say it's the powder or the product that's been heat sterilized. Then, when their claims were all rejected repeatedly by the Patent Office, and again, these were claims that both had heat sterilized in them and claims like 65 that never did, they were all rejected based on the same prior art. They made the same prior art distinguishing arguments to get around those prior art sterilization processes. And then they went even further. The icing on the cake, they said that the products are different. They said that a filter sterilized product is different from a heat sterilized product. They said that a steam sterilized product is different from a heat sterilized product. So they're telling the skilled person repeatedly that our product is only the low dry heat product, and that it is different from all those processes or products of those processes that they disparaged and disclaimed in the specification and the file history. We would say this case is very similar to cases like Chime or cases like Anderson, where, yes, the court looked at the plain language and said, well, that really doesn't tell us anything one way or another, whether it includes or excludes, but that's just the beginning of the analysis. We then move to the spec and the file history. And if we find that clear and unmistakable disclaimer, that overrides any claim differentiation issues there may be. And here we submit the disclaimer is very clear and unmistakable.
When the inventors are talking about experimenting on micronized butesonide, that butesonide is not yet sterile, so micronized butesonide doesn't have to be sterile, right?
Micronized budesonide, used in the examples, Your Honor, when obviously they start with non-sterile and then they apply the so-called inventive low dry heat sterilization process to it to make it a sterilized budesonide. Obviously, in the examples, they can't start with sterilized budesonide because that's their inventive process. So yes, they started with non-sterile and then they went and they sterilized it with the low dry heat. But that's all they ever used and that's all they were ever get to work. So what Astra is basically asking for here is a budesonide product that is FDA approved and sterilized. This patent covers everything. And that's not what they invented. They did not invent budesonide sterilized by any means whatsoever. They told the skilled person over and over, nothing else known in the prior art would work. Matter of fact, they didn't just disparage it, Your Honor. They did disparage it, but they went beyond that. So the disclaimers here are disparaging, saying it just won't work, ruling out every other product in prior art process, and then saying the invention, our invention is only the heat sterilized product or process, Then going beyond that, in distinguishing all the prior art rejection solely based on the process, relying solely based on the sterilization, the low dry heat, to distinguish from the prior art. And again, our fourth point is, again, saying the products. Talking in AstraZeneca's language and argument here, they said that the prior art products are different from a heat-sterilized product. Again, filter-sterilized is different.
But that could well be and not be inconsistent with the idea that all they're claiming is a product. I mean, their point, I take it, is that all of these prior art methods of sterilization had negative impacts on the efficacy of, or the integrity of the molecule and the efficacy of the drug. So that's why our process is good, and separately, why we've invented a product that no one has previously been able to invent. But that's not inconsistent with saying that the process is one thing, and the product is one entirely different thing that doesn't depend on the process, right? I mean, it doesn't depend in the sense that you don't have to include that as part of the claim limitation.
But we would submit it is, Your Honor, when you tell the skilled person that nothing else will work. None of these other processes will work to make this product.
But if I were in this field of the art, and you were much ahead of me, I'm sure, but wouldn't I anticipate that there's going to be advances in other ways of sterilization over the life of this patent? There may come a time in the future where filter processes may be perfected enough to get to the same product I've got. Therefore, I don't claim anything other than the product, recognizing that that will give me coverage into the future, even if these methods that don't work now are proven to work in the future. Wouldn't I claim it just this way, and wouldn't I have coverage of my product despite those other advances in processes?
Well, Your Honor, but the problem is that's not our record here, is that they actually said filter sterilization was impossible for budesonide drug products and drug substances. So how is the skilled person reading this ever supposed to think, wow, they must have covered a product made by filterization somewhere down the line? We submit it's simply not credible and defies logic to suggest that the skilled person reading the totality of this evidence, intrinsic evidence, the spec and the file history, again, where they recount the failures and how this simply will not work, the skilled person could not possibly come to the conclusion that this is a filter-sterilized budesonide product, or steam heat for that matter, or irradiated.
You're saying there were no advances made in any of these other processes over the years since this has been filed?
Your Honor, I can't speak to whether there's been advances in all of those prior processes. I can tell you that as of 1997, the critical date, the record evidence here, both in the specification as well as the inventor and the Astra testimony, was none of this would work. They failed to do it. They admitted they did not invent a filter-sterilized or steam-sterilized product. They only invented
that
the
low came
product.
Later, but they claimed it as a product which covered those advances in technology and other fields. Why not that read?
We would disagree with that, Your Honor, because even if it was pure product language, you still have to look at the disclaimers. When they say...
Well, they're disclaiming... I'm tying... What my question is doing is tying those disclaimers to 1997.
Exactly.
But the claim is not tied to 1997 and covers a product, however made and however used, into the future. And I'm saying your argument discounts that aspect of our law.
It, to the extent it's being discounted, Your Honor, it's only because the skilled person, the public notice function, the intrinsic
record. No, the skilled person sees going to advance in time with the art and is going to recognize, oh, this didn't work in 97. It works today. We can now filterize this, but whoops, it still covers the product claim.
That would be a new invention, Your Honor. The filter sterilized.
The process would be a new, yeah. You'd have a new process invention.
And you can get a patent on that.
Yeah, you can get a patent on it. Exactly.
What you couldn't get a patent on, presumably, would be the product.
But the skilled person, Your Honor, is entitled to rely on the state of this record as of 1997 to interpret these claims as to what they include and don't include. And they would see in 1997 that they don't include.
They would see it's a product claim, and they would say that covers this product, however made and however used.
Your Honor, we would respectfully disagree that you will never find any statements or even hints to that effect in the spec or the file history that it covers a product, however made.
No, that's the law. That's kind of patent law. I teach this in my 101 class. It's the second class. I have a very colorful example I use, but I won't impose that on you.
Well, with that plain language concept, Your Honor, is always subject to whether there's a clear and unmistakable disclaimer in the spec in file history.
This goes back to my question earlier about where's the disclaimer. I'm having, I think, the same problem the Chief Judge is having, that you have separate inventions set forth here, the product being a separate invention from the process, even though the specification disparages a lot of the other processes and asserts that the process described here as invention is new, different, patentable. That doesn't necessarily impose a limitation on the product.
It does, Your Honor, when they told the skilled person that you can't make it any other way.
But I don't find that language here.
Actually, Your Honor, in the specification, they say not just, they don't just disparage.
I don't find anything that says you can't make it any other way.
Statements that the other previous methods of attempted sterilization don't work, but that's not to say that this is the only one that ever could be made to work.
It's the only one they ever disclosed and enabled, and in the file history they repeated that. The other ones...
Right, but that sounds like you're coming back to questioning my initial vacuum case. You don't have to disclose multiple methods of producing a product in order to claim the product, however made. We agreed on that.
We agreed on that, Your Honor, but when you say the invention and you disclose...
We're back to the invention. And if they had said one of the inventions instead of the invention, would you say game over?
If they said one of the inventions?
Right.
If they said one of the inventions is any budesonide product that's
right.
pharmaceutically acceptable...
Right.
That might be different, but they didn't. They said it's a sterilized budesonide product by this means, and even when they introduced the sterile glucocorticosteroid of the invention, they connect it back to made by the present sterilization process. That's the whole point here. And the district court looked at this disclaimer and saw every time they were talking about a sterilized budesonide product, it was always connected back to the sterilization process of the invention, which we know is solely the low dry heat and no other. And then in the file history, they did the same. Matter of fact, they told the skilled person in the file history, you wouldn't even try these other sterilization methods. And even if you did, they wouldn't work. And even if you could get them to work at all, you would get a completely different product from a heat sterilized product. There would have been no need to do that if this was just any budesonide product sterilized by any means. Matter of fact, in the Rule 131 declaration and the Eklund declaration, when they were talking about claims that did not have heat sterilized words expressly in them, they were talking about what's the invention recited in those claims, and they talked about the low dry heat sterilized budesonide product. And that's in the Rule 131 declaration. If this was any budesonide product, because it arose for the first time, why in the world would that declaration describe the invention is low dry heat sterilized product and only give data in there about how it's made. In the Eklund Declaration, when she's describing what they invented, she said the FDA told them, go find a way to make sterilized budesonide. They tried and failed every single way until they got to what she described as their only invention, the low dry heat sterilized process and the budesonide attained thereby. We respectfully submit the skilled person reading the totality of this is never going to come away with this is just any budesonide product. It is a very specific sterilized product by a very specific sterilized method. And I see I'm about 1 minute left, unless
Any words on 603?
Very quickly, Judge Rader, on the 603, it seems now we've now boiled the issues down to this aspect of children. And I think it's worth noting here that budesonide in nebulized form have been approved and used for infants as young as 3 months old for a decade before the invention here.
And if we're looking at obviousness, we had this logical progression we talked about, but the nebulizer's bulkier, it's time-consuming, it's more expensive, you lose more drug. Why wouldn't I be, as a person skilled in the art, led away from that?
Actually,
even for infants, I'll find something else.
The testimony at trial, Your Honor, which was unrebutted from Dr. Wolf and Dr. Barnes, was that actually you would want to use the nebulized precisely because of Your Honor's prior comment that young children have more of a problem or difficulty coordinating the DPI and the MDI. So you want to use the nebulized. And the art, such as Jackson and McCarthy, actually talk about, in fact, that for young infants with very severe asthma, the nebulized therapy is a very significant, important therapy, precisely because you give them something they can use and something that improves patient compliance and convenience, and then using the step-down approach leads to less side effects.
Well, I guess that Astra's own advertisements in Europe in 1994 referred to nebulizing in children down to 3 months, right?
So
the only thing missing there is 3 months, wasn't it?
3 months old, yes.
3 months, yeah. And so the only thing missing there, I guess, would be the once daily.
Yes.
We had this issue come up on the preliminary
It depends on how the court finds on inducement. Our view is if you find inducement, then that ad, in fact, does teach once daily. But, it doesn't say the words once daily in that ad expressly.
Right, right. But that takes care of nebulizing and children down to 3 months.
Correct. And not only that, if you look at the Moeller study, these claims, even the dependent claim 16, the youngest claim range, 5 years old it includes. And in fact, the Moeller study did study children 5 years old with DPI and found the inhaled budesonide to be safe and effective.
But that was a non-nebulizer, right?
That was a non-nebulized form, but the art taught, as the district court found, that the delivery device in the end was not important.
By the way, didn't we already resolve induced infringement last time we were here?
This court preliminarily found inducement infringement in the injunction. That issue was actually
Has
tried.
Anything in our reasoning changed that would cause you to think we've changed our mind? Or?
Well, we believe there is not inducement, Your Honor, and I know Aftec's counsel will address that further, but my point to Judge Bryson was if, in fact, that label induces now, the same label certainly would have anticipated back in the day. So we would say that's an additional ground for participation as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Posey. Mr. Basile.
Your Honor, Richard Basile for Aftec. So 2 minutes, I'd like to save a minute for rebuttal, so I'll talk very quickly. The issue I'd like to address is this issue about the 834 patent. If you're not going to affirm the district court's construction as is, and you are going to send it back, we believe that any construction is going to require that the product that's described, that the claim construction for micronized powder composition requires the particles to be both dry and sterile at the same time.
What about claim 50?
But claim 50 talks about a pharmaceutically acceptable suspension, including the micronized powder composition. That needs to be sterile. That's what their invention was, a sterile powder. And then they used that in a sterile suspension. They're just saying both are sterile. You could put a sterile budesonide powder into a suspension, and that suspension no longer would be, you know, could be contaminated and no longer to be sterile. And so what claim 50 is saying is you're using a sterile dry powder, which is what their invention was, which is the specification in the claim and the prosecution history.
I'm missing your point. Claim 50 says the suspension has to be sterile.
The final
not the powder.
Right, but the invention is, we would say the product claim, the product that they're claiming in claim 1, we're talking about a product claim.
Right.
Claim 1 is a powder.
Right.
Claim 50 is a suspension that uses that powder.
It's a product claim.
Which
also.
Is also, which is part of their invention. And if claim 1, micronized powder composition in claim 1 requires a dry, sterile powder, then if you're using that term again in claim 50, this court is also clear that you need to be consistent with how you use terms within claims. So claim 50 would also then require you to be using a sterile powder to form that sterile suspension. And there's ample support in the specification throughout the prosecution history, in particular on column 4, lines 39 to 41. It talks about, according to the invention, there's further provided a sterile glucocorticosteroid, for example, budesonide, suitably dry and preferably in the form of dry particles. It goes on later on in, this, in that column, lines 48 to 53, sterilization of dry glucocorticoids could be carried out, and that such sterile glucocorticoids, like budesonide, can be used in the preparation of sterile formulations containing them. That's what claim 50 is. It's a sterile formulation containing sterile dry budesonide powder.
It just, the word sterile only appears once in that claim, and that is with respect to the suspension, right?
Right, but Mike, that's correct. But in claim 1, you don't have the word sterile, and we're talking about a micronized powder composition. And their whole invention was how to sterilize and end up with a dry, sterile powder.
I mean, even the title of the patent, sterile powders formulation and methods. There's a, right from the outset, we've got a product and a process, don't we? Not a process incorporated into a product and limiting it in some way we have never really acknowledged.
I'm not sure I understand your question. You can have a product that's patented, and then you can use that product in a bigger product that's also patented. And part of the reason why it is patented is because you're using that ingredient that's patented. And during prosecution history, they distinguished over other sterile suspensions. In particular, in the record, I think the best example is at A01181, where in their in office action response to the rejection, in a section they titled applicant's invention, and in bold font, they described the discovery as a powder. And they say, and again, they use bold font, the pharmaceutically acceptable powder is in the form of dry, finely divided particles. The dry particles are sterilized. That's what their invention was. And then claim 50 is merely taking that invention and putting it into a suspension, another product, and with a resulting suspension that's sterile. Okay. And later on, in distinguishing the O'Neill reference, which described sterilized corticosteroids, they again talked about the fact that O'Neill didn't describe any sterile dry solid, distinguished their invention based on that, and again used bold print to say, stating that O'Neill did not have a formulation that included a powder in the form of a dry, finely divided particles, the dry particles being sterilized. And O'Neill was a suspension.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia.
Okay, and just briefly, with respect to the bond, if the court is going to return the case back to the district court, I believe Apotex is entitled to get an increase in the bond to cover its damages. I don't believe this is a retroactive increase at all, especially if you send the case back. This clear case law is reviewed in the Daiichi case, which explains that if you do send this back, the injunction still is in place, and AstraZeneca would have the opportunity then to decide whether the price of the injunction is worth posting the bond amount. And especially in situations like this, which we believe are an exception, because this is one of the few situations where the longer the injunction goes, the more profitable it is for AstraZeneca. Normally, retroactive increases are frowned upon because the limit on the applicant's liability is gone, and the theory is, and the equity is, it's not fair to them because they're going to be responsible for more damages. But in this case, the longer the injunction goes, the more profits they make, the more money they make, and it'll far out. The totals will be dramatically higher than any damage to that.
I think we have your argument. Thank you, Mr. Sipes. We restored your 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me pick up first the argument that was just made about claims 1 to 50 and whether or not the powder must in claim 50 be sterilized. Probably the simplest way to see that is compare claim 50 to claim 38. 38 refers to a pharmaceutically acceptable sterilized powder. Claim 50 is a pharmaceutically acceptable suspension consisting of a micronized powder composition. Where the claims were making the powder sterilized, it said so. In claim 50, the criterion of sterility plainly applies to the suspension, not to the powder itself. Indeed, that's one of the main distinctions between claim 50 and claim 1.
Can you point me to anything in the spec of the 834 patent that describes sterilizing the solution and not just the powder?
No. Now, remember, what we're dealing with is a case where, in the prior art, this, in some sense, Mr. Ricozzi made our point. This was a bigger advance than usual, because to make the new product, a new process had to be made. In the spec, there's a discussion of the fact that not only can the powder not be sterilized, but there's a reference to Claim 31 to terminal sterilization of the pharmaceutical formulations. So the prior art also failed to provide a way at that time to sterilize the suspension rather than the powder. And that's why when you get to column 5, the top line 1 of column 5 is the invention further provides a sterile glucocorticosteroid, preferably budesonide, so it's referring to the drug substance. And then down at line 13 on column 5, according to the invention, there is further provided a sterile pharmaceutical formulation. So they're recognizing at the end of the day what you want is a sterile formulation. You can sterilize it at the powder stage and maintain sterility throughout, or you can sterilize it at the formulation stage.
Although that paragraph that you just read from references the budesonide as being a sterile, finely divided glucose.
Preferably.
Yeah.
Preferably.
So you're saying that this contemplates that you could have a sterile solution that would not start with a sterile powder.
The sterilization could be applied to the formulation after it's made. And that's clearly the distinction between Claim 1 and Claim 50 and Claim 38 and Claim 50.
In answer to Judge Lynn's question, I guess you're coming around to saying that's sort of a slightly backhanded way of saying that the suspension can be sterilized without the powder being sterilized because of the use of the term preferably.
Correct.
I mean, that's your citation to the
correct. Correct. And also to the discussion not only of methods of sterilizing the powder, but of terminal sterilization at column 2, line 31. The problem to be solved is really, at the end of the day, having a sterile formulation. And of course, the field of invention ultimately relates to a sterile formulations containing glucocorticosteroids. That's what they're after. And that's column 1, lines 19 to 20. That's one of the inventions of sterile formulations. That's what you care about. It's what's going into the patient's lungs that you want to be sterile. There was a lot of statements, general statements characterizing...
That's true. I don't know how important this is, but... That's true, if I understand, with respect to nebulizers, but there are delivery systems that just use the powder itself, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think in all cases you want it to be sterile.
Right. But that would be a delivery system which would depend on claim 1 as opposed to 50.
Correct. Okay. A dry powder, for example, would not use the aqueous suspension of claim 50.
Okay.
That's correct. That is correct. So the 2 points I want to make to about the general characterization of the specification of the prosecution history is it's correct that it was necessary that the prior processes as they existed in 97 didn't provide a way to make a pharmaceutically acceptable sterile formulation. And that's the way they're distinguished, not merely as we have a new process, but rather the result of which is we have a new product. And so, for example, in distinguishing the irradiation technique in column 1, the paragraph beginning in line 25 down to 41, the discussion is it causes degradation. The product itself is not pharmaceutically acceptable. To be sure, in the prosecution, when they were dealing with claims that had a process limitation, they pointed to that process limitation. But they were very careful when they were dealing with claims that were product claims to distinguish it based on product characteristics. And I think Mr. Ricozzi made a point that they never said they were just claiming the product. That's not true. They said it a number of times. For example, at A1448, the statement is made, and again, this was dealing with a claim addressing the sterilized powder. Applicants were the first to discover a practical way to produce a pharmaceutically acceptable sterile or sterilized powder composition, at least 98.5% by weight, which is pure budesonide. As such, applicants are entitled to claim the composition. That's at A1448. They were very clear in the specification, in the claims, and in the intrinsic in the prosecution history, that they thought they were entitled to more than process claims, that they were entitled to product claims, and they used language very specific to do that.
Would you, I'm sorry, wait, you finish?
Yes.
All right. Would you comment, please, on Mr. Basile's argument with respect to the O'Neill reference in the prosecution history? That was at page 1181 of the appendix, first volume.
First of all, I think that those claims are dealing with claims.
This is claims 10 and 11 that were rejected.
So claims 11 and 81 are dealing with claims, I believe, about, let me just make sure, that are dealing with I think they were dealing with this, at that point, with a sterile powder. So they were distinguished that way. They did introduce later on, I believe, claims relating to the sterile formulation, the sterile suspension.
The suspension came later?
I'm aware, Your Honor, that claim 94, which was introduced at A1704, with the introduction of the claim, a sterile pharmaceutically acceptable suspension consisting of a micronized powder composition.
And so that's what had became claim 50.
With a subsequent modification to define the move the sterility to be the criterion for
right,
sterility
right.
at the end. And the discussion there is talking about the new formulation, and that's what connects at A1713 to regardless of how desirable the sterilized butadiene composition might have been, no one except applicants knew how to produce it at the present applicant's priority date. I think they were quite clear that what they were, that they recognized that they had developed not just a new process, but a new product. And the product is not just the butadiene powder, but also a sterile formulation.
Thank you, Mr. Sipes. Anything further?
Just to respond quickly to the bond issue. Given the size of the retroactivity you're seeking, it is, as you would imagine, a significant issue. It's somewhere that the only case I'm able to find for a retroactive increase in the Third Circuit is a case involving fraud, which has certainly not been alleged here. It would be an unfair accusation.
And that's just district court, right? District of New Jersey?
Is that
that's correct. Yes. Well, the Daiichi case itself said no retroactive increase. The issue with Daiichi is different. It's whether going forward you can include the past damages. We think that violates the rule against retroactivity set forth in the Third Circuit in Sprint. But the key point is, as I understand what they're asking now, it's more than that. They want to exceed the bond for past damages, period. And that's clearly forbidden under Third Circuit law under Sprint, that the bond establishes the liability for the injunction. With regard to the desire for, which I'm not sure was expressed, the argument to even increase the bond prospectively to include those old damages, the two things are, one is the rule against retroactivity allows you to move forward in a predictable way. The injunction should not become increasingly expensive in the future because of an attempt to recapture old damages. That sort of undermines the whole rule against retroactivity. And here the key point, too, is the reason we're in this boat is Apotex waited. The bond was set to expire, the bond calculated up to 2009 in December. They waited until August 2012 to ask for an increase. And then since they're asking to shift the cost of their delay retroactively onto us. And the rule in Sprint doesn't permit that.
Thank you, Mr. Sipes. I guess we did reach the bond. That gives you a minute, Mr. Basile.
In response to that argument, there are actually three cases that permit that stand for the proposition that the case can be remanded to increase the bond amount after an injunction has even been dissolved.
So Daiichi is one of them, right?
Daiichi is a district court case. Well, and they distinguished it because they said the bond still existed, which, based on some of the discussions here, might be an outcome that would occur in this case.
Right.
It would clearly fall within Daiichi. But American Bible, which is a Third Circuit case, allowed an increase in the bond after the injunction had been terminated. This court, actually, in International Game Technology, considered the issue and remanded the case after the injunction to consider the possibility of increasing the bond amount. And in one of the cases that...
What was the name of that?
That's International Game Technology.
Right.
versus WS Gaming, 217 F3rd, 850. And a case that AstraZeneca themselves cited, Service Corp versus Guzzetta, it's a Delaware Chancellery case. But that case that they cited actually also stood for that proposition that it's proper to go back. And again, Sprint and Scanvac, they also talk about the fact that it's usually the case, it's generally the case, you're not allowed to go get a bond retroactively increased, only in rare exceptions. And it's our position that this is one of those rare exceptions based on the dynamics of the market. You know, the only thing that happened by Apotek's not coming back...
Want to give us a word on his argument that your delay is responsible for this?
Well, I don't think our delay is responsible for it. I think the only people who got a benefit from this is AstraZeneca. They didn't have to, they haven't had to make the decision on posting a true bond for the true amount of damage they've caused. If we had come back every 6 months and asked for incremental increase, when we came to November of 2012 when we asked for it to increase, they would have been in the same position as they were when we asked for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel on both sides, for an excellent morning.